You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Shift in Action teleseminar. Tonight, we return to the Transformation in Action channel with our host, Cassandra Veeton, ION's Director of Research, and we are delighted to welcome her guest tonight, Eric Greenberg. They'll have a dialogue for about 40 minutes entitled A New Politics, and then we will open the call up for questions from our members. Cassie, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, Eric, I really appreciate you agreeing to come on to this show with us, and I'm going to just introduce you using a little bit of your bio from the book, Generation We, so let me know if any of this is out of date after I'm done. Eric Greenberg is the president and CEO of Beautiful, and that has two L's, beautiful.com, a prepared fresh food company focused on providing tasty, healthy, and real food for retail and home delivery. And Eric has a very interesting history, has founded and established many businesses as an entrepreneur, has, in one example, in partnership with Native American tribes in the Great Plains, started a wind farm, has worked with Acumen Sciences and the Acumen Journal of Life Sciences, also Scient, a consulting firm focused on e-business and emerging technology, and Viant, an internet systems integrator. And I know you've done some fundraising work for UCSF, and that you have been a recipient of the Einstein Technology Innovation Award, so that's pretty interesting. And finally was named by Worth Magazine as one of the 10 most generous Americans under 45. So any of that out of date yet, Eric?
Well, I'll be out of date this year because I'm turning 45. So.
Well, it's just such an interesting background that you have, and I'm particularly interested, first of all, in this book that you wrote called Generation We, How Millennial Youth Are Taking Over America and Changing Our World Forever. And first, I wanted to ask you, what generation do you consider yourself a part of?
Well, I was born in 64, so I guess I'm theoretically considered a baby boomer, although, my birth year kind of has characteristics of the baby boom and Generation X.
Yeah, so you're in that limbo. I was born in 69, so we're sort of a tiny bit of limbo there between kind of 64 and 70 or so. But what led you to write that book? What were you noticing about the young people today that seems different from earlier generations?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, over half the world's population today, and at the time I wrote it, or conceived of it, was under 26 years old. And the millennial generation of youth, which we call Generation We, the birth years are 78 to 2000. There are currently 95 million documented Americans of that age compared to 78 million baby boomers. And in 2016, that's projected to be 100 million versus 74 million baby boomers if you look into attrition. And so what you're looking at is the next large generation. So if you imagine a big snake that has swallowed two animals, one is a little animal and one is a big animal towards the tail, the millennial generation is the generation that is going to really drive American politics and society for the next 40 years, as the baby boom has done in the past. So, understanding them and trying to understand themselves was one of the primary motivations around that, because that is the the next great sweep of American politics and society. And when you couple that with the world demographics of youth in the world, and you really want to make the world into a better place or bring about change, well, you're going to have to win the hearts and minds of the young, which is something that the newly elected president has done.
Yeah,
that was the one thing is the size and importance of the generation. The second thing is that inspired me to write the book is that I have two young children that are 8 and 4, and I've kind of lived the American dream coming from nowhere, and I'm not convinced today that if I were born today I would have had the same opportunities to live the American dream. And I think the American dream and the American birthright is being damaged. damaged. And so what I wrote the book about was as an appeal not only to young Americans about things they need to be thinking about the world they're inheriting, what they may want to do about that, but also was to kind of really put it out there in very stark terms about what it is is happening and could possibly start repairing the American dream. And then what we wanted to do is wanted to figure out what the young people were thinking. So we studied them through proprietary surveys and focus groups and studied a lot of pre-existing research to make sure that we understood the generation. We spent 18 months doing that. And, one of the great things was is we predicted what happened in this election, which was quite, the first time age cohort of youth actually turned an election and made it happen.
So would you call the current administration maybe the first generation political administration?
Well, I can't call it that, but if you notice, Obama was addressing student groups this entire time he was in Europe. Whether he was in Turkey or Prague or wherever else, he was talking in front of college campuses and students and young people. But, if you just look at the numbers, it was 66% to 32% of 30 and under voted for Obama over McCain, and that was an 8 million vote margin. The popular vote was only a 6.2 million vote difference.
Mm.
Then he had about 10,000 people under the age of 25 on his payroll in the election, another 250,000 volunteers. So not only did they deliver the votes, they sold the election. I think it's fair to say that the young people put him in office and gave him the opportunity to lead the free world.
Very interesting. So when you were doing this research, in some ways, I think you were confirming some of your predictions, but was there anything that surprised you?
What really surprised me is the level of civic engagement and concern for the greater good that this generation has, as opposed to my generation when I was coming out of high school or in college. I didn't really think about how I was going to make the world a better place. I was thinking about, what am I going to go do to make money and have fun? And the young people today, they're more inclined to be active in social causes and be more up on world affairs and have more political opinions and discuss those and be more actively engaged. And they're post-partisan, post-ideological, and post-political. They're tired of all the bickering. I mean, they just want to see a better world. And what's interesting about them, whether they're from south or north, east, west, black, white, yellow, brown, they're agreeing on 80% of the issues, Republican, Democrat. It's pretty interesting that they are coming together on the issues in a very, very uniform way. And so traditional political labels don't really fit them. And right now they're gravitating towards the Democratic Party because they just there's a big disconnect in the messaging of the conservative side of the spectrum in them. And it just doesn't really resonate with them. And so right now, they're converging Democrat, but I don't think that is, necessarily a long-term type of thing. But, it's something that could certainly be turned into a systemic advantage if exploited properly.
What do you think this concern for the environment and sort of more of a service orientation springs from in young people?
Well, it's the first generation that really grew up with a view of space and Google Earth, when you start looking at the world as a biosphere and as a planet, and you're doing online gaming with people from around the world and you're hearing more and more about international events because of the access to the internet. I mean, that's one thing. Secondly, we have an unmitigated disaster on our hands, whether it's education system, healthcare, national debt, conscription into long-term wars. It's just, the world they're inheriting is a very, very difficult one, and they're going to be expected to pay for this and fix it. And, I don't think it's lost upon them that's, in fact, what they're going to have to do.
Right. So in some ways it comes from kind of the urgency and necessity, and in some ways it comes from a different worldview.
Well, it's just reality. It comes from reality.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the reality is that, you know, let's talk about debt a second. I mean, you know, it used to be a little over $10 trillion. Well, now they're adding dollars by the day, and that's not the real debt. What the real debt is the net present value of the entitlements out there. And if you take a look at the Medicare entitlement, it's currently estimated to be over $60 trillion, and that's compounding at 8% a year. It was $20 trillion in 2000. And, you know, that's five times our economy. And it's only getting bigger, and the healthcare crisis is getting worse and worse, and increasing every year. You know, whether it's the rate of childhood obesity or obesity in general, or diabetes or hypertension, cancer, what have you. You know, how are they going to pay for this? It's either going to be punitive taxation, or you know, you're going to have to ration it. You know, but something's going to have to be done, and it's being put off till tomorrow. You know, and I think that, you know, you look at, if you look at global warming as an issue, which I think that only the most conservative people would deny it exists at this stage, you know, or global climate change, let's say, if they're 25 years from now worried about evacuating coastal regions such as Florida and Bangladesh and Manhattan from, you know, an increasing ocean due to Greenland melting, you know, the ice cap of Greenland melting and maybe some Antarctica melting, they're going to spend the rest of their lives evacuating coastal regions. They're not going to have a life to live. That's where all the money and all the resources are going to go. And let's talk about carbon a second. If the climate increases the way it is and the tundra starts melting in Siberia and northern Canada and, you know, in the Arctic Circle and all that, the carbon emission from the decomposition of the melting tundra alone will dwarf anything that we have seen from China, India, the U.S., and anywhere else in the world from just normal carbon output from, you know, generating power. And I think, you know, the point's kind of getting across, and there is a sense of urgency about that.
Yeah, it's sort of unavoidable at this point, yeah. I'm not sure I read this in your book, but did you ask any questions about spirituality or kind of inner experiences of the folks that you interviewed? Did you have any thoughts about that?
I tried to stay away, you know, from religion. The surveys in the book, you know, we tried to stay away from religion and spirituality. We asked a couple of questions in there. I'm pulling up the survey results right now. And regardless of any religious affiliations or beliefs, you consider yourself to be a spiritual person. 73% said yes. 26% said no. Do you consider yourself a member of the specific organization community? So, you know, we asked everybody, you know, everything from Catholic to Baptist to Charismatic to Buddhist,
right,
you name it. And then about 33 out of the 731 respondents that answered that, you know, had no religious affiliation. What was interesting, you know, if you're Lutheran, Presbyterian, Congregational, Evangelical, Charismatic, Baptist, Methodist, Seventh-day, Pentecostal, or non-denominational, can yourself be a born-again Christian? And it was a 58-42% yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you extrapolate all that out, 26-58%, you know, roughly about, you know, 15-20% probably evangelicals, or consider themselves to be, which is, you know, if you look at Fox News right now, their average viewership is about 67 years old.
Mm.
So, you know, this whole far right thing is a lot more, is a lot more prevalent in older people.
Right.
I think that people are more, you know, there's probably a resurgence of spirituality, but I think that there's probably less of an acceptance in many accounts of religion itself.
Yeah.
From what I'm seeing. But, you know, what's interesting is I've been covered by a lot of blogs and other things, and the blogs I get attacked by the most are the far-right blogs,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Christian blogs, basically, because I debunk the end of times theory. I don't believe in it. And,
right.
I'm basically, a danger to their prophetic state of misery that they want to put the world through, you know, so I've been criticized for that quite a bit. They do wonderfully reasoned arguments too. I got to tell you, some of the most thoughtful blog entries have been by born again Christians criticizing my stance on end of times.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, and it seems like there is this movement, like you were saying, post-partisan, post-religious, post-dogmatic. In a sense, it's almost a practicality or a humanism, or I'm not sure what you'd call it, but what do you think is emerging that, You know, I was thinking about the altruism and the service orientation, and one of the things that we have seen in our research on how people become more service-oriented and altruistic and compassionate and empathic for others, and their out-group gets bigger and bigger rather than having sort of this limited in-group, is that they move beyond feeling a sense of sort of duty and obligation and sort of the rule-bound, I'm altruistic because it's a good kind of person to be, and or as you were saying, like it, or as you were alluding to, kind of it's what God wants me to be, and moving more towards something that arises from something, a place that is different from duty and obligation and rules, and more into necessity, but also a view of reality that's more accurate, as you said, from being able to see the earth and know that it's a, when seen from space, a pretty isolated, small place in the universe, and therefore maybe worth preserving.
You know, I think the best way of putting it is people want to see, they want to live good lives, and they want to see a greater good for the world. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that they're not going to be capitalistic, want to make money, have fun, or whatever else. It's just, you know, when you start looking at it, you start looking at the world they're hurting, what they're seeing on TV every day with dysfunctional leaders, financial scandals, you know, never-ending wars, you know, what's been interesting, the Obama administration took the worldwide war on terror, you know, out of the lexicon of the U.S. military and everything else, and that's all the Bushies talked about. You know, it's just a different way of thinking about things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and whether you call it spirituality or not, I don't know. I would say that it's probably more hinged upon doing the right thing, mm-hmm. which, you know, evolves from a lot of people's spiritual beliefs. But then again, you know, it's a matter of ethics. Mm-hmm. If anything, I think we're seeing a resurgence of life ethics. Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, the times that we've been in have been so excessive, and the long-term effects of that have been very poor, you know, on the average person, especially if you're in the middle of the country. If you're on the coast, you know, like I think you're on the West Coast, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we live probably in I'm in the Bay Area, so opening a store up right across from Cal Pacific, which I think you are affiliated with.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, if you go out to the coast here, it's just very different than if you're in the middle of Ohio. And, you know, you're looking at, you know, a world in which, you know, you're doing well, you're making $40,000 a year, and, you know, and your house costs you $80,000, and you have no way out.
Right.
And I think that, you know, this is not lost upon people, you know, and they start seeing these big inequalities of what happens on the coasts and then increasingly overseas with the celebrity culture that we have in this country. I think it's, you know, it's starting to, you know, the tidal shift is going the other way.
Now, we talked about it a little bit, but what more would you say about the new politics?
Well, I think that, you know, people are going to have to get things done and actually have an agenda they adhere to. What's interesting, I'm writing an op-ed right now and basically saying that, you know, what's interesting about this president, he's doing everything he said he was going to do, you know, in earnest, which is the first time anybody's ever seen it. I don't think anybody knows what to make out of it. The Republicans can only criticize so many things at once.
Right.
So now they're criticizing that he's doing too much at once because they can't figure out how to criticize every single action he's taking. I think that, you know, the new style is going to be a younger, more vigorous leader, you know, like an Obama or people, you know, that have that kind of a personal inclination, orientation towards things. But, you know, at the end of the day, people don't want to see partisan bickering. You know, all the partisan bickering isn't going to erase the, if you count the national debt with the Medicare entitlement, the $75 trillion these kids owe. Trillion. And it's not going to end the wars. And it's not going to create jobs for the middle class. It's not going to educate their children. And it's not going to end healthcare rationing. And it's not going to help, you know, the 45 million people that can't get decent healthcare or don't have any healthcare get decent healthcare. So I think, you know, when you have 2.5 million people losing their homes this year, a lot of those people, probably a lot of these young people have been touched by that. And a lot of them have had friends of theirs in service fighting valiantly in Iraq and Afghanistan multiple times now. So when you raise with that reality every single day. You see your parents losing their jobs, you can't get health care, you know, a relative dies of cancer, a couple of your friends get conscripted, one ends up getting its legs blown off, the other one has post-traumatic, stress syndrome or whatever they call it. And, you know, I think that tends to shape people, you know. I think that has a long-term effect on people, and this has been going on a while. And, you know, it's interesting, in the latest economic boom, which was, I think, artificial in many aspects, you know, the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. And you had Republicans running around saying, like, you know, Cheney, I haven't seen two Americas, you know, or Phil Graham, who was McCain's economic advisor, saying, you know, there's a lot of whiners out there. You know, and they didn't declare that we were in a recession until October, until it was foregone that the election was going to be lost. And then they said, well, the recession actually started back a year ago. And so they were in denial, lying to the American people for a full year, just about.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing that I think that the young people are tired of. You know, what they don't have the ability to do is have an independent voice to where they can make sense out of it yet. But I think, you know, the common sense is starting to play in, and this is going to affect their decision making. Do people do what they say and say what they're going to do? And is it have a base in what's best for everybody? And I think those are going to be the underlying factors. And I don't think that's a foregone conclusion this generation is all going to stay Democrat. It's a matter of the leaders and the parties, you know, getting effective solutions on the table. And with the fractured Congress we have today, I think we're going to have our challenges. But, hopefully the president will be successful in getting some things done, and we'll have some good fortune, and maybe it'll turn a few things around.
Well, one of the things that we've focused on quite a bit at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and what some of my work has been about, is looking at transformations in consciousness and how people make these big shifts in their perspective that lead them to a new way of life. And I was really interested in reading about what led you to write Generation We and the stuff you went through in 2004, and then sort of a two-year makeover, and then your experience in the Amazon. And I just wanted to hear a little bit more about that.
Well, I mean, the whole book was written to shift collective consciousness. That's exactly what I was doing. The whole purpose of the book was to help shape and shift collective consciousness towards restoring the American dream.
And what happened to your own personal experience?
No, I was just, you know, I've always been interested in the greater good. And I had something I had to get off my chest. And, and nobody really covered the data in a political way. A couple of authors did a very nice job in describing that there is this thing called the millennial generation, but they were talking about it more from a psychographic or demographic standpoint. They weren't talking about the politics and about what needed to be done to protect and restore the American dream. And so that's what I wanted to do. Was really focused on that because, you know, as I said in the introduction of my book, it was about my children. You know, I want them to have the same opportunities I've had. And, I think it's incumbent upon us, we're adults, it's incumbent upon we adults to, to leave the world in a better condition than in which we inherited it. And, you know, quite frankly, the baby boom generation has not left a better world for its kids than it inherited from its parents. Mm. No, it's not. It's an absolute disaster right now, financially, militarily. Climate-wise, you know, there's record amounts of poverty and starvation going on in the world. You know, it's just, you know, everywhere you turn, there's a problem. Now, I'm not a pessimist by nature. I'm an optimist. But, you know, if you don't have a good dose of reality, you're never going to change anything. The first step in fixing a problem is acknowledging it. You know, I mean, it's what the first thing they teach alcoholics in a 12-step program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and I think America needs, and the world needs a good dose of truth right now. You know, get it on the path of reparation. And that's what motivated me to write the book, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you know, it was putting a good dose of truth out there.
Yeah.
And hopefully it would influence a number of people to, want to do more and inspire people to do more.
It looks like some part of your path has had to do with connection with indigenous peoples and indigenous elders, and wondered if you could say more about that.
I go hang out in interesting places and do interesting things, and that's all I need to say about it, really.
Mm. Well, so what's next on the horizon, do you think, after the Generation We book? Anything coming up for you that's new and exciting, and any way that this work is evolving?
We're looking at writing another book on what I look at as the great reconstruction of society, driven by the age cohort of this generation, which is going to have to implement it. So we're actively looking at writing that, I spend my time. I was having lunch today with a U.S. senator, I spend a lot of time with political leaders and others, talking about policy. I'm kind of a policy wonk. So for me, it's staying engaged and active in progressive political causes and building businesses that help people. Ultimately, I'm in the food business to feed people real food. So that way, the healthcare crisis was caused by food, bad food or fake food. And the only cure is food. It's not pharmaceuticals. It's not, intrusive treatments and a broken medical system. So my whole thing is to take on the healthcare situation with the word I trademarked, which is food care. Mm-hmm. And that's convergence of healthcare and food. That's the only thing that's going to make people better. So my whole focus is on trying to do what I can do to make the world into a slightly better place, and hopefully there are a lot of people like me that have a similar collective consciousness, so all of us together can make a difference.
Well, and I can imagine, I guess, what you're talking about is real food, meaning whole food, organic food, things that are not filled with toxins and...
It's natural food. Yeah, it's real and natural. But, organic is not necessarily good for you. And you've heard of something called arsenic, I'm sure. Mm. Yeah, it's a poison. Organic fields are sprayed with arsenic because it's a natural substance. It's in the legislation that you can – that's how all that beautiful organic spinach doesn't have any bug, holes in it. It's the arsenic that kills it at the beginning of the season. So that's considered organic. So – organic isn't necessarily perfect. I think the more important thing is eating natural and then not being elitist and trying to get people food, that's free of steroids and hormones and refined sugars and refined flours and refined vegetable oils and other things like that. It's getting them to more natural food. The first thing you'd say to a person if they have a problem, let's say, with their weight is, why don't you start off by walking 30 minutes a day versus, start off with Lance Armstrong's training for the Tour de France.
Yeah.
So my whole thing is to, make things incrementally better by serving real food that's natural, fresh, and whole. And, not everything's organic, but it's all natural.
Mm-hmm.
But, get and eat healthier, but if you want to get all pastured eggs and all pastured poultry and everything else, the costs go up by 5x. There's not enough supply out there.
Right.
So what ends up happening becomes a self-selecting prophecy for the rich only. And that's another thing I don't think is fair. I think that what we have to do is make a good food supply broadly available to the average person. And right now today, if you go into a ghetto somewhere, whether it's a Hispanic neighborhood, in East L.A. or, an African-American neighborhood in Chicago, there won't be any grocery stores. They're called food ghettos. And so people have to take public transportation just to get to a grocery store to buy a fresh piece of fruit. So what ends up happening, people eat three meals a day in fast food restaurants or in processed food in boxes from liquor stores. You get all these people running around on television and everything else. Oh, you just eat your fruits and vegetables and you're this and you're that. And then all of a sudden, where do the people get it from? Especially if it's two working parents, or better yet, they're not working.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no money. And then there's something else is, you have a food pyramid that's done by a lot of these, great scientists in the United States that says eat all this dairy. Well, it doesn't make a difference between a cereal and a whole grain, first of all. And there's a big difference in vitamins and fiber and everything else. The second thing is it's what's not really written about but is true is that only 40% of the American population, it's typically people of European background, are lactose tolerant. So if you're dark skinned, you can't tolerate lactose, yet it says you have to drink X number of things of milk a day. And so what we're doing is we're poisoning people. They can't digest the milk they drink, yet it's on the food pyramid. It's been endowed by scientists, didn't take into account genetic differences between people. And so what ends up happening is we get this big distribution of inequality that's built into the system. You know, another example, this is the school lunch program. I think, you know, you get something between $1.50 and $1.50 a day, you know, for a school lunch for the federal subsidies. Well, I can tell you what you can get for $1.50. You can get white flour, sugar, and refined vegetable oil, and fat, and a cheap source of protein that's probably loaded with steroids, hormones, antibiotics, fungicides, herbicides, and pesticides. And that's what we're feeding our kids. And it's all denatured of vitamins. And then we're thinking, okay, well, they're not cognitively developing, and they have ADHD, so let's give them drugs. Let's feed them speed. We call it Ritalin. Let's feed them speed so they can concentrate after you give them sugar all day long and give them sugar crashes. You know, after you give them a 24-ounce Gatorade, when you take, you know, which is high fructose corn syrup, after you've taken the sodas out of the schools. You know, and so, you know, this kind of stuff is what, you know, what I think is the stuff that has to be brought to the public collective consciousness, if you will, and changed. You know, it's a good dose of reality. A good dose of reality has to be set in, and people have to tell the truth about it. You know, we have to become a society that's less about making money, and there's nothing wrong with making money, but more about doing the right thing. And if we're making money at the same time, that's wonderful. But I don't think anybody should make a hero out of people that are sugar peddlers and fat peddlers and people that peddle chemicals, and they make a ton of money, and they get on the cover of Fortune magazine, and then the next guy on the cover of Fortune magazine, somebody's exploiting the healthcare crisis to make even more money from that. You know, I mean, there's something wrong here.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is not, you know, to me, when you want to, you want to talk about spirituality and everything else and karma and everything else, it's dead wrong. I mean, it's immoral. It's unethical. You know, I can't for the life of me justify it. Yet people justify it. And it's not the individuals in the system that are bad. They're just part of a machine, and they're doing their job within a machine. It's a self-perpetuating mechanism. And you can't blame an individual for that. They're just trying to make a living. But what you have to do is you have to get the collective consciousness to understand what the system is. Otherwise, the system doesn't change.
Right. And it seems like there are so many different ways to do that. And some of those you go over in your book, ways to, even if you have 15 minutes, but even better if you have 15 years to dedicate towards, it, you know, first, as you say, acknowledging the problem and getting all these inconvenient truths out really, really into the public consciousness and kind of waking up from the collective dream. And then what's next? I mean, what when you, you know, for someone who has a lot of resources, it may be simpler, but for people who don't have a whole lot of resources, what do you suggest in terms of,
you know, I was giving a talk to a youth group last week, and they're like, where do we start? I said, you know what? First of all, your age cohort, you're no longer youth. You're an age cohort. You guys got to find three things you're going to focus on. And to me, it's the debt. You know, the wars are going to end, okay? It's the debt. It's the health care. You know, it's the environment. You know, and yeah, you guys probably care a lot about education too, but you know, the healthcare is going to drive the debt, it's the environment, so it's three things. I think that people have to find something they're passionate about, and they have to get involved and engage in a civic organization. They have to give back. They have to vote. And, you know, everybody has a little bit of time to get engaged, whether you're reading books to children, you're teaching people how to read, you know, you're volunteering time at a food bank, you know, you're helping people at a hospice. It doesn't matter. I think people have to give back to society and do things for others. Just that one shift of collective consciousness there by many people changes the way people have a framework towards the world and changes the kinds of people that will succeed in the world. So for me, it's just find one thing you're passionate about and do what you can do in the time that you have to do something about it. And it doesn't mean that you're doing great things. You know, what's great about society is that if everybody takes a small step forward every day, collectively, we take a large step forward. But not everybody's built to be a worldwide leader, and not everybody can. I mean, you know, I'm never going to be President Obama. You know, I mean, President Obama is a great man and somebody of extraordinary talent and timing. And not everybody can be like, you know, Obama or a king or, you know, other great leaders that have emerged, you know, in this country. But you know what? Everybody can be as a good person, and everybody can care about something, and everybody can give back. Everybody can pay attention. Everybody can, you know, read past the smokescreen and say, is this the best thing for all of us, or is it the best thing for some of us? I think everybody can take a good dose of reality And, you know, the way I wrote the book, you know, I mean, you know, the books are purchased, but at, you know, www.gen-we.com, I put it out there as open source, along with all the research that supports it, all the focus groups, interviews, everything, the bibliography, post-election results. And then we produced a video that was done by award-winning producers that got over 7 million views in 5 weeks about this generation, everything. And it's all out there as open source. And you know, spread it around.
People,
it's free.
www.gen-we.com.
It's all free. It's all open source. My whole thing, I turned down 2 major book publishers. You know, I got a lot of critical acclaim in the book. We've been nominated for major awards and everything else. And I turned down 2 publishers, major contracts. And they couldn't get over the fact that, wait, so you're going to give the book away for free?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And wait, we want you to publish it next year. I said, no, I'm publishing it before the election because I don't want anybody to accuse me of revisionist history.
Right.
And, well, it doesn't fit in our time frames. And I'm like, I didn't do it for the money, guys.
Right.
You know, and they said, wait a second, you didn't publish the book to make money. And what's your long-term plan with this? I said, my long-term plan is to inspire 10 to 15 young people to do something.
Yeah.
You know, and whatever other effects it has above that, that's wonderful. But, you know, my whole motivation was to help people understand the world that we're inheriting today and to want to do something and then to take action on it. Really, really simple.
So what do you think is the, if there is one, is there a difference between this generation and the generation, say, in the 60s that was, you know, the protest generation and the...
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny. You led into the title of the book. You know, remember those old, when we were growing up, those old Pepsi commercials, it's me generation?
Yeah.
I was passing back notes with my collaborator one day, you know, and I was trying to get to the essence of a paragraph. And I said, you know, it's not the me generation anymore. It's a we generation. That's how I got to generation we. I think it's we versus me. It's very simple. You know, it was all about me. It was all about, you know, as Obama would say, the dorm room arguments, you know, of the past, you know, and, you know, and you had the nerds fighting the progressives all the way across a generation. Now, you know what? The kids don't want to fight amongst each other. They just want to make a better world. And so I think it's now the power of what's in the best interest of people versus what's in my best interests.
Mm-hmm.
And this financial fallout, and you take, you know, people that are scum of the earth like a Madoff and other people like that, you take this whole fallout about people that were so into their egos, so into what they could accumulate, so into their status, so into their consumption and everything else. It's a complete antithesis of what I'm seeing from these young leaders. And I'm seeing some amazing, amazing young people come along that all they want to do is work on making the world a better place, and they have no economic aspirations. It's the most refreshing and it's a shocking thing because it's not like my generation. I mean, it is a different generation. And what I'm thankful for is that they're here because, you know, America needs another greatest generation or else, you know, we're going to have a very hard time, you know, maintaining our standard of living and our leadership in the world if we don't have that.
Good. Well, this is usually the time that we pass over the opportunity to ask questions to the listening audience.
Yes, I have a question. Eric, you talked about this generation is tired of listening to the bickering between the bipartisan bickering. Any thoughts on how we can make some changes in the bickering and change it from the, as you say, from the divisiveness to the cooperation?
Well, you know, it depends on what you're inclined to do, but I think 2 ways you can do it is, first of all, if you find a radio or talk show host or pundit offensive, one is write a letter or get a bunch of your friends to write letters as well and let that outlet know that they're offensive to you. And secondly, don't buy goods or services from the advertisers that advertise. You know, and this has happened with O'Reilly recently where I forget the major company that pulled advertising from his show as a result of some of his offensive positions. But, you know, the bickering's not going to stop from the pundits unless they see the public collective consciousness change, firstly. Secondly, I think that, You know, my other thing is I've been telling young people to run for office and for people to vote for them. You know, I think that what we have to do is start supporting a new generation of leaders that's not beholden to the institutions of the past, or support our leaders that are more progressive in their thinking about embracing new ideas.
And are you saying then that the pundits are really the ones that are fueling the bipartisan bickering?
I do. I mean, there's no investigative reporting left. You know, you get people. You know, every time you watch a major news. I watch a lot of the news shows, and they throw four or five images on the screen. All of them, you know, they look pretty and they, you know, are handsome, and they're there to get a sound bite. And you know, you look at the resume of what they've done in their life, and they've been commentators their entire lives or writers. You know, not many of them have ever generated, or done anything with their lives, and you know, they're just there for opinions and sound bites, and they're good at it. And you know, their whole thing is to cast doubt on what's going on. And you get the right side, left side, and this and the that. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, when you get somebody like a Rush Limbaugh saying that he wants to see Obama fail because that's good for conservatism, what in the world does that mean? How many people lose their jobs and go without health care and die, and services, you know, and factories shut down, and people losing their homes so he can prove his point? I mean, is this guy an American or not? I mean, what is he? And the fact that nobody calls him on it, then you have Michael Steele publicly apologizing to him, you know, because he said something that was offensive to this radio guy. I mean, what is he? I mean, who is he? You know, he's a recovering drug addict, and there's nothing wrong with that, but let's call it for what it is. He's not somebody morally superior, and people have to call it for what it is.
Thanks, Eric. Your straight talking really has energized me.
Oh, well, I'm glad. I get carried away sometimes, but it comes from the heart.
I hear that, and that's exactly how I received it.
Great, thank you. We've got a couple more folks who have unmuted their lines. If you've got a question, go ahead with your name and where you're calling from.
Well, I think I'll venture a question.
Hi, Ted.
Maybe just a comment.
Go ahead.
This is Ted from New York City. I don't know how to phrase this, but I think the American dream that you refer to has become the American nightmare. And it's very good that you're putting it right in the face of everybody with your book, because that's the only way people can wake up, because they've been living in the collective dream for so long.
You know,
their American dream is materialism and how much money they can make, and it's gotten so out of control that capitalism has become an abomination. I mean, they've carried it much too far. And all this that goes on is simply the quest of the next book.
Well, you know, the epilogue of the book, I'm going to read you something right now, so you must have either been reading it or channeling it, but I wrote something called the We Declaration, which was the first part of the book that I wrote, and it's at the end. But the first section says, "We, the youth of the United States, are badly served by the governance and direction of our nation and the world. Our future is in peril. If the misconduct against our generation, humanity, and the planet continues, the American dream our parents and grandparents experienced will become our American nightmare."
Hmm. Oh, I haven't read your book, and I didn't channel it. But I think we're more or less on the same wavelength.
And so we got to do something about it. That's what this is all about, is giving people a dose of reality and motivating them to want to do something about it.
Well, I'm not part of the younger generation.
Nor am I.
74, so that puts me in a totally different ball game. But I think, like the young people do today,
well, we have a chapter.
Is to people to change their own consciousness. In order to get a collective consciousness, everybody has to work on their own state of being so asleep to what's going on, but also what's going on within them, and how they can change their consciousness and make that shift to another more perceptive reality.
Mr. Greenberg, I have a question.
If I could.
It's kind of a complicated one. My name's Lucia, and I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I'm a person who is very supportive of the bipartisan movement, I guess you might call it. I'm joyfully voted for President Obama, but I don't agree with this business of we can't look back at the past, we can't dwell on what's happened, we have to move forward, we have to look forward. I think that that is a terrifying idea, because I think that the lack of prosecution of people at high levels in the 70s for offenses against the Constitution that they swore to defend and uphold was the author of the mess that we lived through the last 8 years. And I think that if we don't get back on our foundation, we are going to carry into the future the seed of something that I can't even imagine it would be so horrifying. So when you look at doing that, it then turns into a very partisan, I mean, the reason that President Obama is not okaying a special prosecutor right now is because it isn't politically wise. You know, he's worried about the idea of what, you know, bringing people like John Yoo and Dick Cheney up on charges for getting up a national international television and saying, yes, we torture people. Yes, we did that. So what? Kiss my ass. Excuse the language. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Help me with this. Help me with how you get to moving into the future, but also moving into the future on a right foundation.
You're right. It is a complicated question, and a lot of the times when our society has become overly vindictive, we've done a lot of things that, in retrospect, aren't that smart. And you know, Obama, in order to implement his agenda, needs the support of many people, many of which don't necessarily agree with everything he does. So if he turns into a vindictive man, he's not going to get anything done. He's going to become a failure. Let me finish, though. One of the things I like about what he said is he cannot govern out of anger.
Right.
And I think that's a very perceptive statement. There are some egregious things that have happened, but let's look at the impact of prosecuting a former vice president of the United States. If all of a sudden everybody that ever serves is up for prosecution by the next generation of those that assume power, for whatever reasons, I mean, they went after Clinton for God knows how many years for Whitewater, you know, and could never get him. You know, for whatever reasons, if you set that precedent up, it's a never-ending cycle, and it's a cycle of retribution. So I don't think we're in a perfect world, but, you know, if we're going to deal with the $70 trillion in debt and ending a couple of wars and getting health care fixed and a few other things, I'd rather him use his political capital on that rather than, putting people in jail. And, yeah, some bad things have happened and some things that I don't agree with have happened. But, you know, there has to be some semblance of prioritizing. And then you take a case that, you know, out there recently where we had an overly zealous attorney general prosecuting who became the governor of New York, Eliot Spitzer, who then turned out to be, you know, and many accounts, a very problem guy, you know, doing his thing with his prostitutes, but yet, you know, putting himself forth to be some morally virtuous, you know, powerful man. And, you know, I think the most dangerous things are the zealots that make themselves into, you know, heat-seeking missiles, and we don't really know what's really motivating them or what kind of demons they have. So one thing I like about the president is that he's focusing on the priorities. And I think, you know, first things first, let's figure out how we're going to get our economy back on track and get health care to people and get the environment, you know, changed and get energy solved and things of that nature. But, you know, I mean, there's no perfect answer to this, but, you know, we can stay angry. Or we can think, well, we got our guy elected, now let's go get something done with him.
But what are we without rule of law? What are we? What are we as human beings?
Well,
I mean,
you know,
not part of what you're talking about when you talk about the we generation? Doesn't
well,
it
you know,
on the rule of law?
I believe it does, but at the same time, you know, if you want to get something on the political environment, you have to work through and with people.
Uh-huh.
And so he has to pick his battles. And, you know, we, you know, one of the things in the book I point out is the degradation of civil rights, you know, through the Patriot Act and other things like that,
right.
You know, which are very, very dangerous. And a lot of people don't understand the gravity and magnitude of those changes in law and the powers granted to the executive branch. And, you know, there is no perfect answer here, but you know what, I think that he needs to spend his political capital wisely right now, because you know what, he doesn't control the Senate, and you know, he has to win an election in 4 years, and he has to have his party win elections in 2 years in order to maintain his pluris and his ability to get things done. So one has to be very careful, and I think that, you know, you know, at the end of the day, you know, karma, you know, karma is really what it's all about. So, you know, people will get theirs one day, maybe not immediately, but it ends up happening eventually.
I want to thank you for that, and thank you for what you're doing in the world.
Yeah, the other thing in reference to what the woman was just talking about was that if you focus all of the our energies, all of the publications and everything on prosecuting, then we're not moving forward. We're not going to a time of cooperation. And we really need to focus on how do we work together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that there are definitely ills in the world, but the main focus really needs to be how do we make changes, how do we move forward, how do we work together, going from competition to cooperation.
Yeah. We've got about 5 minutes left till the top of the hour, so we can probably take one or two more. Who has a question for Eric?
Yeah, hi. This is Maud Pollock. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Maud.
In New York, yeah. I wanted to say something because we were talking about Rush Limbaugh, and in my school of thinking, I have found that the leader that is chosen represents the median collective consciousness or unconscious. So we've chosen Obama, which shows that we have really grown in our society. A Rush Limbaugh, on the other hand, reflects another kind of collective unconscious. He's really only the expression of a lot of people who are very angry, period.
Maud,
so,
do you have a question?
Right, okay, you go ahead and ask the question.
Yeah, you know, this is Philippe in Canada, and my question was, have you looked outside of the United States at sort of the global issue of politics? Because America sort of is the leader in terms of global politics, and my concern is the issue regarding India and China gaining a huge economic advantage. And, you know, my question is, have you looked at other political systems?
Well, you know, I mentioned a comment at, you know, at the beginning of the hour that over half the world's population is under 28 years old. And if a lot of the internet technologies are developed or invented in the United States, a lot of things that take hold here take hold in other places. Now, it would have been a quite ambitious project to try to study every political system in the world and comment on those. So we really focused on the United States because, you know, A, I'm an American, and B, it's something that I'm passionate about, you know, and it's where I live. But, you know, I do believe that this can be something that spreads to other places. I'm sending books to Kenya to be given out in schools. I was just on, believe it or not, an evangelical Christian radio station in Canada last week where they were agreeing with my positions, and spent an hour with them a little north of Toronto. And what's interesting in our Facebook group and everything else, I'd probably say a third of the members are from other countries. And so there is a clamoring for this in other countries. And what I've said to people over and over again, you know, if you're in another country, you know, you know, do something, you know, do something about it, you know. But, you know, I don't think America can change what we have right now and try to change the rest of the world. We got to focus on getting our standing back and getting our own house in order, and hopefully the example of that will influence other people. But we have a lot on our plate right now. But, you know, Canada, the United States, you know, we're in it a lot together because we share North America, and we're very, very homogeneous in our character to many extents.
Eric, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the demographics of who's buying your book and what are they doing with it. I just downloaded it, and it did not ask me, you know, who I was or, you know, where I lived or anything of that nature. So I don't know if you're really capturing a lot of the demographics of...
No. Well, no, we did that on purpose. We sold, you know, a modest number of books. It's not bad. It's pretty good, actually. And I can't, you know, we have thousands and thousands of downloads, and I don't know how many times it's been passed. But one of the rules in viral things is that if you ask for information, people are less likely to take. And so, you know what? I really don't care where it goes other than I want it to go. And I wanted to put up as few impediments as possible on this whole open source thing. So for me, it was just putting it out there. And then if you put it out there, things happen with it. You know, 30 years from now, hopefully some young leader somewhere, some political leader somewhere will say, well, what shaped your life? Well, I downloaded this interesting book off the internet called Generation We, and really motivated me and made me decide to have a career in public service. Well, then, you know what? That kind of answers the dream I had for the book. You know, was shifting of attention, shifting of consciousness. So, you know, for me, it's going to take the course that it takes. The energy's out there, you know, the intentions out there, the thoughts out there. And I didn't want to lead this group. I didn't want to become a political leader. I don't want to become a political leader. So it was just a matter of me putting it out there and letting it take the course that it does.
Definitely buying a copy for my two sons. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Amazon.com sells them.
Yeah, that's where I'm going.
Great. Eric, this is Cassie. I'm just going to restate it again. So Generation We, How Millennial Youth Are Taking Over America and Changing Our World Forever by Eric Greenberg, who we've been speaking with, and Carl Weber. And the website is www.gen-we.com. And it sounds like you have a Facebook page, so I guess you can probably just look up Generation We on Facebook.
Yeah, and what's really cool is that our video, which is out on the website or on YouTube or on Vimeo, that video was done by the people that did Inconvenient Truth for Al Gore and do Nike commercials by the night, and Stephen Marshall won the Sundance Award. It's a 4-minute, you know, video, and it's amazing. And, you know, it's a truly amazing video that 7 million people viewed in 5 weeks.
Well, it's really exciting, and I really enjoyed having the opportunity to get more acquainted with your work. And
there's one
that.
Other thing. If people want to quote the book, pass it around. You know, people use my video and presentations and courses, quotes, whatever. It's all out there on the Internet. Use it. Use it. That's what it's there for. Share it. Show it to people. Talk about it.
Very good. Well, thank you so much again for taking the time to be with us.
It's been a pleasure. You have a great evening.
You too.
We hope you enjoyed this offering from the Shift in Action Partners program and would like to sample more. Partners of the Institute of Noetic Sciences gain access to a weekly stream of inspiration, wisdom, media, and spirited exchange. The program includes live weekly teleseminars with visionaries who are lighting the way forward: Marilyn Schlitz, Dean Radin, Belvy Rooks, Larry Dossey, Candace Pert, Brian Swim, and many more. Our live teleseminars are then added to an extensive archive of audio and video on our website at www.shiftinaction.com, with new offerings each week from teachers like Marianne Williamson, Edgar Mitchell, and Louisa Teach. The site offers the latest in community-building software that allows you to engage every piece of content as a focal point for education, exchange, and action. Join us in exploring the frontiers of consciousness.